Hello, this is Tim League, founder and CEO of Alamo Drafthouse Cinema. Whenever I think about the looming apocalypse brought about by Austin being the hub of hand-printed weaponry, I think about Reeve Hamilton, the Texas Tribune, and the Tribcast as being the shining beacon that is going to drive us to a better place and a secure future.
Thank you, Tim. This is Reeve here with the Tribcast for the third week of June and the last full week of the special session, at least special session number one. I am joined by executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Managing editor Brandy Grissom.
Hello.
And senior reporter Jay Root.
Hey, y'all.
Welcome. Should we delve right into the vetoes that happened on Friday?
Sure. I guess the headline was ethics. He vetoed the funding for the Public Integrity Unit vetoed the funding for the Public Integrity Unit in Travis County, which, because it's the local prosecutor where the state treasury is, has all the state officials. And he also vetoed the sunset bill for the Texas Ethics Commission. It doesn't kill the Ethics Commission because it's a constitutional agency, but it took away some reforms that they had put into the sunset bill. And then I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but he cut some things out of the state budget and vetoed a total of 26 bills. Is that right?
I think the 26 includes the two line item vetoes.
24 bills and two line item vetoes in bills. Right.
Okay. What am I missing here?
He also vetoed...
Lilly Ledbetter Act. You know, can we talk a little bit about the way news gets out?
That's not what I was going to say.
But how news gets out, because the first thing that happened... Have you noticed how, like, news is being broken by Twitter all the time? Like, staffers will say before... And instead of, us finding out that they vetoed these things, like, the staffers in the offices are, like, tweeting out, oh, hey, Perry's going to veto this. But the interesting thing about that was the veto of the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which is, you know, equal pay for women, mirrors the federal act, that came out, I want to say, an hour, maybe even more than an hour.
Like the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah, before...
It was significantly more than an
hour. No, it was out for a long time.
Was it out for maybe 3 hours?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Maybe four.
All right, well, it was out for a very long time, but what was interesting about that was that it allowed the Democrats to really get a pretty good set of headlines out there, and that sort of drove the news, because for a long time it was like, okay, this veto's coming, it's coming, it's coming. We had a story that was attributed, actually, to, I think, Senator Davis, Wendy Davis.
Right.
D. Fort Worth. And... so that was sort of an interesting thing, you know, that came out, and that made a lot of news. And
it wasn't
then, boom,
just, it
he
wasn't
came
just
down
Twitter,
with,
though.
Well,
Watson blogged about it. Dee Austin, state senator.
Well, right. You know, Rodney Ellis had a press release out, Democrat from Houston. They were.
That's true, yeah.
This is going to go on like this, isn't it? You know, they had this thing where they basically, the governor's office didn't manage the news right.
I mean, they did that. It happened earlier in the week, too, on other things. I mean, right. When he added to the call, when he added. Transportation to the call, maybe.
Right. You know,
Corona broke the news. So, and I don't think the governor's office saw that coming. You know, that other people were breaking news and on their own terms before they were able to kind of control it.
The transportation thing probably wasn't as bothersome because, yeah, we're going to put transportation on there. But you know, you're right about getting the spin out of hand on the Ledbetter bill. The thing sat out there for 3 or 4 hours. The story was basically told before the governor weighed in, and most of the media, I mean us and everybody else, you know, we publish on the web, and so you publish what you have and then you add to it. So he comes in, you know, you've just lost your chance to be in the lead of the story, really, and you're the governor also reacted as you get down here. There's a protocol in these things where the governor or the governor's staff calls the senators and representatives and says, hey, your bill's about to get whacked by the governor. Heads up. You know, and then right. Usually there's a press release from the governor, and that's how we all find out. But
although Dan Patrick was very upset, he said that he was not given a heads up that his bill that was going to provide money for training for public school employees to get concealed handgun license training, that he didn't have a heads up on that. He said, to my knowledge, my office was not contacted.
And why was that vetoed?
I think that I know that the governor mentioned the fiscal note in it.
Right.
There's a $10 million fiscal note in it, and Patrick claims that that fiscal note was grossly inaccurate. It was, you know, totally inflated. He said at most it was $300,000 or $400,000. So, but that was an example. And you know, maybe they got to where they thought, well, we can't let people know about these vetoes in advance if they're going to leak it out. So, but if there's any staffers out there that are listening, if you do get a heads up about some kind of veto or something, you know, call me. Hey, you know, text me, call me.
His number is
512-716-8600.
Well, and Perry's veto of the Lilly Ledbetter Act was his reasoning was because it's already covered by federal law.
It's already a federal law. This
and
is
we
duplicative.
Are always ready to just bow to federal law and let that
we
be the
we love federal law. Right.
You know, in the federal fight, the Republicans in Congress fought this. It was a big signature issue for the president and the administration, and you know, I guess Texas wasn't having any of that. But it passed pretty easily, didn't it? Sailed through the House and Senate pretty easily.
Yeah, I don't think it was a
there
huge...
wasn't much debate.
It was. I don't think it was.
Well, he vetoed that SB 15, which sort of tweaked the rules for public university system regents, which passed very easily, but was also sort of a slap by the entire legislature.
Right.
To
wrap their knuckles. Right.
So that wasn't really a surprise, but I mean, just because something passes easily doesn't mean it's safe. You know, he also vetoed just while I'm talking about higher ed stuff. He vetoed a lot of special item funding for programs around the state. Mm-hmm. So these are items that were not in universities' initial legislative appropriations requests, and then were added the special items, and they included
$1.5 million for a Mexican American Studies, right?
Yeah, for a Center for Mexican American Studies at UT, a study for petroleum engineering at his alma mater, Texas A&M University, some stuff at University of Houston, a lot of programs sort of. We're going to have to wait to get their money maybe next time.
There were a couple of things that he didn't veto that were sort of on the list or that were on the watch list. The big one was HB 5, which is the education bill that cut the number of tests from 15 standardized required. from 15 to 5. It was bugging Reeve. I had to clear my throat. And also changed the graduation standards for high schools. And a lot of members from both sides of the aisle, the bill passed pretty easily in both the House and the Senate. But walking around the floor while they were voting on it, a lot of members were like, you know, I really like this part of the bill. I really hate that part of the bill. And to some extent, at least particularly in the House, a lot of it was, well, we really trust Jimmy Don Acock. We're just going to vote for this. But then it got to the governor's office, and there was a lot of hemming and hawing for a couple of weeks. And he finally signed it.
Well, and the Education Agency and the Higher Education Coordinating Board still don't like the bill, which, you know, often they are tasked with sort of carrying out the governor's wishes on those issues. So, I mean, people sort of thought he probably also doesn't like the bill. But he not only didn't veto it, he did a ceremonial signing and did a little press
He did
avail.
The whole show.
Yeah.
You know, the politics of that, you know, during the last election cycle, candidates for the House and Senate all over the state, you know, both parties were hearing more about standardized testing than they were hearing about budget cuts or teacher firings or any of that other kind of stuff. That was the issue. So I think a lot of people really wanted to take at least that part of it home.
And so that sort of shuts the door on the regular session, right? Now we know the outcomes of all the bills that passed during the regular session, but we are still in the midst of our special session.
Lucky us.
How's that going? Brandy, you've been watching this thing that was added to the call late about 17-year-olds.
Right.
Can you tell us what that is and where it stands right now?
Well, the thing is that last year there was a Supreme Court ruling in a case called Miller versus Alabama, where the court said that you can't have mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles. And the Supreme Court considers juveniles to be anyone under the age of 18. Texas law considers juveniles, 17 and under is what the Supreme Court says, and Texas law is 18 and under. So what that left where Texas was a hole for 17-year-olds who, if they were convicted of capital murder, there was no longer any sentence available to them, because in Texas, 17 and up could be considered the mandatory sentence for a capital murder at those ages is either the death penalty or life without parole. In 2005, the Supreme Court had already taken off death penalty off the table for 17-year-olds. So now prosecutors are left with about 20, 17-year-olds across the state who are charged with capital murder, but they can't take these 17-year-olds to trial because there's no sentence for them if they go to court and get convicted.
So what are they, do you just hold them till they turn 18 and then for their 18th birthday they get a capital murder charge?
Well, I guess that's what prosecutors were trying to figure out. And really what they would have been forced to do is charge them with a lesser crime, such as murder, just plain old murder instead of capital murder, which carries a sentence from, I believe it's 5 to 99 years instead of life without parole or the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And so prosecutors are saying to Governor Perry, look, we need options here that are more severe than just charging these kids with murder. So the governor agreed to add it to the call, and the Senate has passed SB 23 by Senator Joan Huffman, R-Southside Place.
Whoa, nice.
First time. so she, the, her bill.
Not that they passed the bill. Nice that you identified her correctly.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So her bill would require, would mandate a sentence of life with the opportunity for parole after 40 years for a 17-year-old who is convicted of capital murder. And that is the same sentencing guideline that is in place for 14 to 16-year-olds in Texas who are certified as adults and convicted of capital murder. So her argument and the argument of prosecutors who support that bill is, look, that's what we already do for other, you know, juvenile murderers who are considered as adults. And so it just makes sense to do this this way.
Why did this not happen during the regular session? Why are we doing this in special session?
It passed in the Senate in special session. And
In regular session, you mean?
Right, yeah, in the regular session.
Which was a special thing.
It was special. Yeah. It was a special regular session.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make it onto the calendar in the House. So. Huh.
Just seems like one of those slam dunk, okay, prosecutors want this, let's go ahead and do it, bada bing, bada boom.
Well, is it going to be a slam dunk now that they have, you know, that and like two other things to deal with?
Well, that's the thing. Like, now there's more attention and more consideration being given to it and more debate about some pretty serious constitutional questions that are coming up after the ruling, which is, if you are 17 and you are sentenced to life with opportunity of parole after 40 years, what does that really mean? So there are some studies that say the average life expectancy of prisoners is 39 years. So if you're sentencing someone to not even be eligible for parole till after 40 years, some who oppose this bill argue you are essentially sentencing them to life without parole.
Huh.
And so in the House, they had a long debate in the Criminal Jurisprudence Committee yesterday about just what that bill means. And so there's a House bill by Representative Canales, Terry Canales D.
Edinburgh.
Edinburgh?
Mm-hmm.
thank you, Ross.
This is a fun game.
So
we need some Tito's in here.
I'm in.
His bill would allow a little bit more flexibility. So juries could choose the sentence and they could take into consideration a number of factors about the age of the person who was charged with murder, the sort of home environment they grew up in, all of these different factors, and decide whether to sentence the juvenile from 25 to 99 years rather than just mandating a sentence of life with opportunity for parole after 40 years.
Yeah. So this was easier during the regular session when they didn't really have time to think about it.
Yeah. And what does that mean for the abortion debate? We just experienced that this week.
You know, Glenn Hager took out the headline of this thing when it started was the governor talking, I guess, in December of last year, right before the session started, about he wanted a fetal pain bill that would outlaw abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And the first thing Hager did when this thing got to the Senate floor, they have an omnibus bill now that has to do with facilities and all these other things involving abortion regulation. And the first thing he did was say, we're taking the fetal pain part of this bill out. So there's some question as to whether they're going to pass that in its own form or another form.
The House is set to debate that bill in committee.
Right. So when we're running out of time, Tuesday's the last day here. So we've got that bill and a couple of others.
So 17-year-olds out there, this is the time to commit
murder. Kind of pending. You know, you've got
five days.
Yeah, you've got the 17-year-old thing. And it's actually sort of on track if they can find an agreement. They've got time for that. the abortion legislation could come down to the wire. The redistricting legislation could come down to the wire. And the other really big pending issue is the transportation funding. And, you know, that looks like might get resolved this weekend one way or the other.
If stuff doesn't get resolved, then do we just come back on Wednesday for special session number two?
I assume if it was emergency enough to call them into special session at $28,000 a day, that probably still is on Wednesday.
Well, the, you know, watching the governor is a difficult enterprise these days and trying to figure out what he's going to do. I mean, we don't know if he's running again for governor. We don't know if he's running for president. We don't know if he's going to call a second special session or...
Well, didn't he say that he was only going to put items on the call where there was some sort of general agreement that things that looked like they were going to pass, so...
Well, it sounds like with the 17-year-old thing that there doesn't seem to be general agreement, right? There seems to be growing debate.
So, well, some of this is probably going to fall apart. I mean, we don't know exactly
things
what it is,
that.
but things do happen to fall apart at the end of sessions, including special sessions. And, you know, so no matter what happens, there will be people clamoring for another special session. There always is. But,
right.
You know, whether or not the governor calls one.
Will Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst be one of those people? He was clamoring for a whole list of things in this special session that didn't get added to the call.
Yeah. And if, you know, Perry said basically we've run out of time to add new issues to this session. If you start a new session, you know, you start the clock again and you lose that argument for a while. Hey, if we're going to be here all of July, why don't we go ahead and do XYZ?
Can I ask a question? So when the Senate had their debate about the abortion bill, which you were just referring to, and they passed the bill, but they delayed and delayed and didn't take it. I mean, the debate went on until almost midnight. If they have just a few issues and plenty of time to deal with those issues, why not just come in the next day during the day like normal people and debate it?
You know, they never stop debates in the middle of debates. And, you know, it's sort of a legislative tradition. Once the debate starts, you keep it going until you reach the end of it. The other thing, you know, there's two things here. One of them is, you know, kind of what happened to the 17-year-old sentencing thing. They have time to consider these things, so the arguments get drawn out. You know, there's more time on each task. And the other thing, that the reason that these things are all being considered in special session, maybe with the exception of the sentencing guidelines, is that they were too controversial to pass in the regular session. Redistricting and the abortion bill were both stuck in the Senate on the two-thirds rule. The redistricting thing was stuck in the House because the speaker didn't want to mess up all of the other issues in the session with what is always, you know, redistricting always blows up the legislature. It always blows up every legislature. That's what it does. So, you know, a lot of it is that these are the most contentious issues and there's not anything else to do. So the debates draw themselves out. I guess the abortion debate drew itself out so much that the lieutenant governor went out and got a steak dinner in the middle of it.
Well, then, yeah, that's true. And he
Man's got to eat
and have a nice Cabernet.
When he came back to talk on with the Senate floor, he said that he was meeting with his consultants, at, which I guess was supposed to be a better answer. There's also been a little Twitter controversy about so Dewhurst tweeted out a picture of a Planned Parenthood ad and said, this is why we passed this anti-abortion bill or this abortion restriction bill. And so the Democrats were like, wait, I thought you said this was about women's health. Because
right.
that's what Glenn Hager said was this was about.
And the ad that you're talking about was the ad that says there would only be five clinics where this was available
right.
if this legislation were to pass. All five of them are within the triangle kind of described by Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, and San Antonio. So nothing in West Texas, nothing in El Paso, nothing
right.
in East Texas, nothing in South Texas.
Well, those are just small parts of the state.
Just, you know.
So, well, I mean, you know. It raises a little bit the question of Dewhurst, and is he in some ways a little tone deaf? We talked a little bit about that before we came on.
I think you can have a steak in the middle of a debate, but you shouldn't have it in a restaurant and where everybody's sitting around watching. And, you know, I mean, it's just
especially a Capitol hangout where people are going to see you.
Well, right. It's a big lobby hangout. He went to a steakhouse, you know, relatively close to the Capitol, and, you know, that's asking for it. I mean, really? This is the big issue that you asked the governor to come back for a special session for, and that you said was, you know, told your supporters was one of the most important things to you, and then you leave in the middle of the debate? Really? And go sneak a bite of steak in your office.
maybe we just don't get Dewhurst, though.
Maybe people don't realize how good the steak is.
Taking the other side of that argument, though, what difference does it make if he's in the room, like, for the debate itself or for the outcome of the legislation?
Probably very little, which he probably realizes, and that's probably why he went and got a steak dinner.
Okay, so let's play that game. So do you really want to say that, you know, it doesn't matter whether I'm in the room or not while I'm presiding over the Senate?
I just think it's sort of, it speaks a little bit to a trend of self-inflicted wounds, that of things that he says or does. I mean, for example, this, I think it was the Belo station in Dallas.
WFAA. Right, this interview he just did.
Right, in which he said,
he threw his
staff under the bus and said, they didn't get me. I had a bad staff, basically, during the Senate race.
I had a new staff and they just didn't get me. This is why he lost the Senate race, a year ago.
And that's, I mean, that is a bit, you know, it just seems sort of mean-spirited and distasteful.
If you can blame yourself or blame somebody else, you should blame somebody else, I guess.
But how does that make you feel if you're on his staff?
Not great.
Well, most of them aren't.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
That's a good point.
He's going to have another new staff for the next
they
election.
They went and got somebody else.
Right.
Who they understand.
Well, let's use this as an opportunity to move and look forward to future campaigns. We suspect that he's running for re-election, right?
Right. And 19% of Republican voters say that they would vote for him. And 10% say they would vote for Dan Patrick. 6% say they would vote for Jerry Patterson. And 5% for Todd Staples. The real big number in there, and the most interesting number in there, is the number of people who haven't decided. 61% said they haven't thought enough about it to give an opinion. If you're an incumbent office holder who's been in the particular job that you're in for more than a decade and in statewide office since 1998, that's not a great number. You know, if you look at the governor's race by comparison, you know, we set up a fake governor's race with Rick Perry and Greg Abbott. We don't know what either one of them is going to do yet. But, you know, if they did run against each other, how would that go? And right now they say they would vote for Perry, 45% to 19%. Only 25% are undecided about that one. You know, and that's a race with you know, that's a complete fantasy race. You mm-hmm. know, most people have formed an opinion one way or the other on that one. It's just interesting, you know, that the lieutenant governor's race has got that little attention to it and that little inclination to it. It almost runs like an open seat.
But isn't it always, I mean, people like really focus on senator and U.S. senator and governor, probably actually more governor and then right. U.S. senator. And then once you get below that, it's just like under the radar. People don't. And so having a lot of money is a good thing, but coming out of a race that you lost and everybody thought you were going to win, you know, Dewhurst enters that race. It's going to be a tough race for him. And I don't. Do you see any way this doesn't go to a runoff situation?
No, I mean, you know, another way to look at that is to say the other three named candidates had 21% to his 19%. So the question is, you know, is there a runoff, and is Dewhurst one of the guys in a runoff? You know, that's exactly the formulation of the U.S. Senate race a year ago. You know, is there going to be a runoff with Tom Leppert or with Craig James or maybe with Ted Cruz, and how's that going to go? And, you know, Cruz's strategy from the very beginning was, you know, I don't have to in the first round of this. I'm not worried about David Dewhurst. I just have to outrun those other two guys. And he did that and keep David Dewhurst under 51%. He did that.
Are his prospective opponents, though, as talented politicians as Ted Cruz?
I think Todd Staples has certainly been a talented politician. He's run really good races. Jerry Patterson is, you know, I mean, he's a reporter favorite because he's, you know, he's sort of like the John McCain. He'll say, you know, the maverick phase of John McCain. And he always fights above his weight. You know, he ran Dewhurst in 98 to a two or three point race, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, maybe a little bit bigger spread than that, but it was very close. And it was, you know, with a fraction of the money.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I think Patterson can live off the land a lot better than a lot of candidates because of his maverick stance, and I think he has a little bit of that libertarian thing. I mean, he'll get some of the Ron Paul types to vote for him. He has a committed, I'm sure small, but committed following. Mm-hmm. So I think you can't rule Patterson out for a runoff possibility. Patterson in a runoff with Dewhurst, I mean, you still have to give Dewhurst probably the edge there because of the money advantage or the name ID and all of that.
I gave Dewhurst the edge all the way to the end of the Cruz race, too.
Right,
and then the other guy here, you know, the guy who actually pulled the best of the three is Dan Patrick. He's the only one not proven in a statewide race So the question is his base in Houston big enough to build, you know, this kind of a contest out of? Can, you know, can he get, amass the money and the support to be a contender on a statewide level with three people who've already won statewide races?
And I think people are already gathering tape on his shock jock days.
I'm sure that's right, yeah. Nothing like being a DJ in your early days.
But we were dinging Dewhurst for being over few blocks away at Austin Land and Cattle earlier. What about Perry going up to New York?
Perry,
his New England trip during the special session.
So, before he got to New York, he made a little stop in Washington, D.C., and did something that we're familiar with, you know, an oops moment. He had another oops moment. He confused Lebanon and Libya. He meant to say Libya. He said Lebanon.
This is awful. It's like going to a kid's recital and listening for the mistake. You know, it's every time he speaks.
The thing about it is that Rick Perry could have a lower than normal amount of gaffes, but the minute he has a gaffe, it's like, oh, I remember this narrative track. It's deep as my legs. I mean, it's really burned in. It is really, really burned in that he is sort of a gaffe machine. And this was one of the, you know, this was a sort of a stepping out moment. He gets up there. There's a lot of.
Where was he?
He was at a Faith and Freedom.
And he had a relatively small crowd, right? Weren't some of the other speakers were drawing bigger crowds? Rubio drew a bigger crowd, and Perry's talking to a room. It's interesting to watch the tape because he's kind of talking in sort of a low voice. It doesn't come across as like a big public address at all. It's a lot more talkative. But yeah, it's Faith and Family Conference, I guess.
Right, and you know, it's one of those moments where you're sort of stepping out again into the spotlight. There's national reporters there. And, you know, he stepped in it again. And I think that is like the big problem for running for president again if he does. And then, of course, the other problem, which we found in our poll, is that if Ted Cruz also runs, it wouldn't even be close, right? I mean, Ted Cruz is like has really knocked Rick Perry off as the go-to conservative Texan. Is that right or not?
It's 2.5 to 1. It was Ted Cruz got 25%. So the fantasy primary, we took a bunch of names of people who've been mentioned because at this point nobody's declared. It's a 2016 race. Ted Cruz got 25%. Rand Paul got 13%. Marco Rubio got 11%. Rick Perry got 10%. And then Chris Christie and Paul Ryan at 8%. Rick Santorum and Bobby Jindal at 2%. Only 21% of the people in that race said they hadn't thought enough about it. But if you just look at the two Texans in the race, you know, last time we had two Texans, it was Perry and Ron Paul. And Perry always swamped him in this thing. But in this deal, you know, Perry or Cruz, if you just look at those two, it's 25 to 10.
And we should say that we're doing a sort of a longer, deeper podcast about the UT Texas Tribune poll that will run on Friday. But, you know, one of the things we talk about there is that this is not a predictive of what would happen. It just sort of shows in Texas how people feel right now about a presidential race that's a decent ways away.
Right, right.
So it doesn't mean that for sure Ted Cruz is going to win and trounce Rick Perry.
It's just a look at this list of names and who'd be your favorite right now. And it's amazing that, you know, virtually nobody in Texas had any idea who Ted Cruz was 18 months ago. Boom.
It's a remarkable rise, and he's remarkably popular among the grassroots conservatives that Rick Perry, you know, has been courting his entire career. And so, you know, sort of a move over Rick Perry, move over David Dewhurst, move over you guys who have been here for a long time. This is the new kid, and he's, for the time being, I mean, in some ways in Washington, he's been kind of the bane of existence of these more moderate Republican senators. But, in the Texas grassroots, he is
so hot,
very, very popular.
He's the deal.
Yeah, well, it's not like, I mean, the people who he is the bane of their existence in D.C. are not very popular with the grassroots
in
Texas.
That's true, yeah.
He's unpopular with people who are really unpopular, which makes him more popular. It's pretty great.
Yeah, well, I guess they're okay in their home states. I mean, they're getting reelected, but...
Right.
As long as we're doing hypothetical matchups, if Dewhurst runs for re-election and Perry runs for re-election as governor, what happens with all these people that have been waiting in the wings? All these people that
the first name on that list is Greg Abbott. You know, does the attorney general who has the biggest war chest of anybody in Texas politics? I think it was around $17 million at the end of December. It's in that range. He has enough money in his pocket to run a Republican primary without making another fundraising call.
Well, and he's all set up to go. He's got his office open.
He's got his people hired up. So does Greg Abbott, if Rick Perry wants to run for re-election, does Greg Abbott run against him? Does he step down to the next race and run against David Dewhurst for lieutenant governor? Does he say, ah, heck with it, I'm just going to be AG? That gets interesting.
Dewhurst really complicated this whole thing by losing that Senate race because...
Yeah, he sure did.
You know, if he had won the Senate race, then I really kind of think Rick Perry would be running for re-election right now because I just don't know who could take... would have the stature to take on Rick Perry, unless it would be some like businessman that came out of nowhere. But who would have the stature to take on Rick Perry except for Greg Abbott? And I don't know who that would be. And so then Abbott could go and run, you know, have a clear shot basically at lieutenant governor probably.
Well, and it's been the Republican way in Texas to wait in line and, you know, we'll have an orderly succession and this one will move on. Kay moves on. You can move up and Rick will move on eventually and you can move up. And Ted Cruz jumped the line and messed everything up.
Well, there's that. But also, I mean, who ever thought of people like sticking around for four terms, for four-year terms? I mean, that was never really on the radar. And in the days when the Democrats dominated Texas, I mean, for a long, long time, nobody ran for more than 3 2-year terms.
And a lot of those fell short.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, to have this sort of permanence in the at the top of the ticket like that is not common. And so we are clearly at a crossroads. So what Rick Perry decides to do is pretty huge.
Well, it's time for us to move on from this podcast. We don't want it to be accused of having any permanence. That's for sure. So
we need a term limit on this podcast.
Exactly.
It feels like it's been going for 13 years, but it's only been about a half hour.
If you have questions or comments, you can email them to jroot@gmail.com. No, sorry, just tribcast@texastribune.org. I hope that's not your real email.
It's not.
On behalf of Jay, Brandy, and Ross and our producer Todd, we would like to say thank you to Shiny Ribs for providing our theme music. I'm Reeve. Thanks for listening. Texas talking. Texas talking. Does that sound like wind? I guess technically that's what it is.